The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner. I am the producer of the show, and we are so excited to have you join us today. We have a fantastic guest. He is a close personal friend to Typology, Al Andrews. You're going to love Al. Al is a counselor, author, and speaker, and he really is an integral part of the musical world here in Nashville. He's the founder of Porter's Call. Now, the mission of Porter's Call is to be a service of counsel, support, and encouragement to recording artists and their families, and to provide a safe and confidential refuge for artists to deal with the issues they face at no charge. Since the beginning of 2001, more than 1,000 artists from all different genres have walked through Al's door. Al is an Enneagram 2, and we are so happy to have him on the show today. Hey, that's it for me, Anthony Skinner. I'm so excited you're going to get to meet our good friend, Al Andrews. And now, without any further ado, here is the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Al Andrews, my good friend, welcome to Typology.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Brother, you have one of the coolest jobs in Nashville.
Well, thank you.
And I probably don't go a week without someone telling me that, this is not an exaggeration, Al Andrews saved my life.
Well, that's a really kind thing to say. Thanks.
Yeah, it's not an overstatement. In fact, we had a guest in here recently who said that to us. We have lots of mutual friends. Mm-hmm. We know lots of people in the music sphere, and I can't tell you how many have said to me at some point or another, oh, that Al Andrews. I went through this period of my life, and it was horrible, and Al Andrews put me back together. And you have a remarkable legacy here in town. But so take a minute and just tell people what it is that you do.
Sure. I am the director of this thing called Porter's Call. It started about 18 years ago. That's why there's a lot of people that maybe say some things. And basically, it's a service of counsel, support, and encouragement to recording artists. And we offer it for free. So anybody in town who's a recording artist and needs someone to talk to and needs some help walking through things can come to Porter's Call. And over the years, we've grown now, so it's not just me people are talking about, but I have two other folks on staff and an office manager, and we have a little place in Franklin, and the name comes from an old 5th century monastery, where the porter was the person in the monastery who, when a sojourner knocked on the door, they'd call out, "Thanks be to God." Porter's Call. And they'd welcome them in and help them find the way to what they need. Mm. And so we thought, instead of being therapists, let's be porters. Mm. And when people walk in or knock on the door, we help them find the way to what they need. If it's talking about their past, we can do that. If it's helping them with their marriage, we can do that. If it's somebody that's depressed, we can work with that. And we can refer people if we can't help them. But it's just a place to come to find your way.
Mm. What better job for an Enneagram 2?
Yeah, it's perfect, isn't it? I can help.
But, you know, again, it's like how beautiful when you leverage your superpower to do something wonderful in the world, right?
Indeed, yes.
So, in your understanding of Enneagram 2s, if someone said to you, describe what one is, tell from your perspective as a 2, what is a 2?
Well, the main word that comes to me is someone that wants to be of help. And in the more unhealthy part of it, it's someone who needs to be of help and must be of help. And in the healthy part, it's someone who's available to be of help. So that would be my core understanding of it, too. And I'm sure that you can help me out with that to expand my vision of it, too.
No, you actually just really helped me.
Okay.
You just articulated something
so... Of course I helped you. Sorry, okay.
But no, but you said it so concisely. I love what you just said that... That, you know, my understanding of a two is it's someone who wants to be of help. An unhealthy two is someone who needs to be of help.
Yeah.
And a healthy two is one who is available to help.
Yeah.
Well, let's just close in prayer and call it a day.
Okay, amen, yeah, for real.
That pretty much, I mean, I just think, you know, that pretty much covers the territory. You came in and you were about to tell me a story. You said, because I said to you, I said, hey, man, what do you want to talk about today? He says, well, I was on a hike this morning and I remembered a story that was quintessential to material. And I said, well, hold on. Let's wait till we get on the air.
Yes.
So I want to hear this story.
In fact, I was telling Nita, my wife, earlier, I said, I just remembered this. So it would have been about 40 years ago when I was 25. And I was, one of my favorite all-time movies is the original Miracle Worker with Patty Duke and who else? I can't remember her name. Anyway, and back in those days, if something came on TV, you had to watch it because there was no taping of it or anything like that. And I saw that the Miracle Worker was coming on TV. And I just couldn't wait because it has my favorite scene of all time in it where Helen Keller realizes what language is when she's 1.5 and she says the word water. And it's just the most beautiful scene in any movie. So you got to watch the original if you haven't seen it in a while. But anyway, I was watching this movie on TV and there were commercials and everything. And the scene was coming up, right? The classic scene was coming up. And the phone rang. And, of course, I answered it, you know, because it's very responsible and perhaps helpful to answer the phone. And someone was just calling that I hadn't talked to in a long time to check in. And I had this dilemma of do I... watch the show that I've been waiting for weeks, or do I say to this person, I didn't even think about saying, can I call you back in a half hour? So I stayed on the phone because I didn't want to disappoint the person, or I'm not sure why, you can ask me, but I stayed on the phone. And internally, I raged.
Wow.
I was just mad at this person. And they didn't do anything wrong. But I felt so responsible to have the conversation or to not say or disappoint them or something like that, that I stayed on the phone and I missed it. Right. I missed the scene in the movie. And thinking back, I was going... oh my gosh, I was so too. Yeah. I guess that's what you are. But I was so unaware of my life at that point in time and unaware of motivations and unaware of things. And so there I was. Like today, one, I probably wouldn't answer the phone and would just call the person back and continue watching what I was watching or doing what I was doing. But at that time, there wasn't an option not to answer the phone. And once I answered the phone, I was there and could not pull myself away, which looking back, I go, oh my gosh, that was crazy. But it was real to me at that moment. And looking back at the dilemma, one, I'm glad to know I've grown a bit.
Yep.
But thinking about it today, I was going, wow, I was really entrenched in an unhealthy part of being a two at that point.
Yeah, that's a big theme for twos, which is a sense of panic, actually. Mm-hmm. Is maybe the word I would say. A sense of panic surfaces when their own needs collides with the needs of somebody else.
Ah, that's a good way to put it. Because that's more succinct into what happened. My need was to watch this movie. Their need was to catch up. And my need would be subservient to theirs.
Right. And then you panic in the beginning, like, what am I going to do?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Then you do what Tiggers do.
Yeah.
Which is meet the needs of to sublimate your own needs unnecessarily.
Yes.
To that of the person on the other end of the call.
Yes.
Which then turns into resentment.
Yes. It's amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
Which they would never pick up.
No.
That you were resentful.
Oh, no.
It would... No.
I was really good. No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't.
They would only pick up the bless your heart.
Yeah, bless your heart. Or they might seem... They might finally pick up... He certainly is being a little quiet.
he seems distant.
Yeah. But no, they wouldn't have picked up on the resentment. And yeah, thinking back on it, I'm going, oh my, I'm resentful for something that I did.
Mm-hmm.
Resentful to someone else for something that I did.
Mm. Mm. You're a great therapist, a great spiritual director. You, in my experience, incarnate the best of two wisdom. But my hunch is, as you've said, you've been through a season, or you began in another place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can only become wise with time and experience and awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess a question I have for you is, looking back over your career, and you know, that's a considerable amount of time, what makes a truly great helper?
Mm. Wow. You know, I think, I'm sure there are a number of answers to that, and I'll start with one that comes to mind. I think a truly great helper knows that they're a part of the process, but not the whole process.
Mm.
Knows that they're not the only one that's going to help with this person. And I don't think that's always been my stance.
Mm.
Earlier on in my counseling career, I would have felt that I was absolutely necessary to this process.
Mm.
And that if someone was going to be helped, it was going to be me, which is both arrogant and not accurate. But over time, I think to be of help means to know that I'm a part of it. I think early on, one of my mentors realized that when people left my office and we would do supervision, I would take it home with me. Mm. I would feel it. It would bear a huge weight on me. And he really helped me once when he said, "Al, people are very resilient. And often the people that you're helping have been dealing with this thing for 15, 20, 30 years. They'll make it till next week."
Mm.
It was really helpful, both to kind of redirect me in my thinking and to understand that I play a part, but somebody's own journey also plays a part, and other people play a part. And I think there was a time where one time I'd been working with somebody and for a long time, and they saw a bumper sticker and it kind of changed their life.
Right.
And it kind of helped me be aware that there are other things involved and other people involved. But also just an understanding that God is at work and I'm not the final answer here.
Holy smokes. That is like pure two wisdom, because what you're describing there, I think, as I hear it, is the move from pride to humility.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So pride, the deadly sin of the two, which is the belief that I'm indispensable,
mm-hmm.
that this person, this group will not be able to function, get better, progress, whatever, without me.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And the pride piece there is the myth of indispensability, mm-hmm. as well as this belief that I have all the time, treasure, talent, resources to make it happen for this other person, to make them well, when in fact I don't have all the time, treasure, talent, resources, time in the world to help another person. For a two to say, I'm just a part of the journey of helping and healing in mm-hmm. another person's life, just a part, I just mm-hmm. play a part, that is to me an indication of tremendous health.
It's been a long time coming, Ian. It really has been.
Okay, so can you tell me, you say that with such gravity. I want to know what that
means.
Well,
you know, again, if I go back to my 20s and early 30s, I just spent my time looking around of where I could be of help.
Mm.
And I wish I could say that was noble. In some cases, I think it might have been. But I was just the most helpful friend you could ever have. Mm. I would show up. If you needed me to show up, I'd help move you, even if my back was hurting.
Mm.
My radar would be out to help people. And what I think was going on in a lot of those situations was it fed me knowing that they would think well of me, and they would perhaps like me more if I'm, they perhaps like me more or think well of me if I did that. And I would keep my reputation of being a super helper up. So I did that to my own, I lost in that situation because I was not attendant at all to my own needs, because others' needs were in front of mine. And again, in my heart, that was not a noble thing,
mm-hmm.
but it was a necessary thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think about my own needs. Mm-hmm. It would be like, let me survey the room and find out what other people need.
Mm. Yeah, we often say that when a two walks into the room, their attention immediately migrates toward a person, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that the two is carrying in their, or the questions the two is carrying in their mind is, what do you want? What are you feeling? What do you need? How can I meet it?
Well, there's that.
But, you know, here's the deal. That's your superpower is attunement.
Mm-hmm.
It's emotional attunement.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this uncanny intuition when you're around people. You know, I could say to somebody, how are you doing, really? And they go, yeah, I'm doing fine. When a two says to me, how are you doing, really? I just start crying. Because they've got like some kind of a window into my soul, man. And it's like,
you're letting out the secret. I'm really not that great a therapist. I'm just a two. And people start crying and feel like I did something.
Well, I will say this. I did have someone say to me once, and this is a true story about you. An artist said, I went to Al and I was describing some hellish experience growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And Al started crying. And I realized that he was crying for me, tears that I couldn't myself make contact or generate. And there was Al actually having my tears with me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Which is really quite beautiful, isn't it?
As you say it, it really moves me.
Yeah. That's pretty profound, right? So when did it all change? I mean, you said, okay, well, you know, boy, there's a lot of years here. Can you, like, what changed and when for you?
That's a really great question. I think the beginning of change came when I went to therapy. Probably in my early 30s. And I was just exhausted. And just, you know, I was afraid of relationships, and but I'd never ask for help. And things weren't working in my life, and I was going through a depression, and it was just finally I began to ask for help. And that was the beginning of it, was just saying, I need somebody to help me. And that was when, that was the start of the shift, I think.
The shift from sort of occupying that sort of unhealthy two space toward getting in touch with your own needs and desires and wants. Is that what I'm?
Yes. I grew up in a lovely family with parents who loved my sister and me, one of the things was that in our family, there was one primary acceptable emotion, and that was happy. And we're going to be happy, and we were. But what that means is if sad things happened, I would just metaphorically, we'd break into song, the sun will come up tomorrow. We wouldn't, but metaphorically.
Right.
You know, it's like if our dog died, we'd get another dog pretty quickly. And so, therefore, that translated for me into I really am not going to bring up my needs. I'm really not going to bring up the things that are going on inside of me that may make everybody uncomfortable, that may pull away from the happy. So I just kind of push those down. And at a certain point, sort of like a volcano, you could just tell the mountain was bulging. And that's what really caused me to seek help, because the scaffolding was just beginning to break down. And so beginning to express a need was the start of it. And then over the years, you know, it's funny, I was, the unhealthy part of it too is still something I struggle with. I told Nita even yesterday, I said, now, Ian invited me to do this, and it's a really busy time. And if I say yes, it's because I wanted to be helpful or not wanting to disappoint him, or because I think I have something to say. And I came up with the last one, you know,
right?
That, or that you could evoke it from me. But it, so it's still there. It's still a, I still feel the magnetism of that unhealthy, and I guess that's how life is, but
yeah,
but it still pulls on me.
Well, these are deeply embedded patterns.
Oh yeah, you know,
because I think part of it is just fixed trait stuff, right? It's not, it's this is part of, like, in the marrow.
Oh,
material,
yeah,
like
it really
born
is.
With it. Then there's the added layer of what we get pick up growing up in our families, like like you've just described, that feed into the formation of a particular type of personality style. I don't think I'm ever going to break loose of all of the errant beliefs and crazy story that goes along with being a four, you know?
Yeah.
But I can, and I think we all can, learn to have enough awareness, as you just described, to be able to stop and say, now, why am I doing this again? am I on autopilot when I say yes to this, or am I sort of actually doing this for the right reasons at the right time, you know? And of course, there's always times when it's like, well, it could be both. Who knows? Yeah, I'm just going to run with this, you know? It's too hard to know for sure, right? But, you know, we try and do the math in our heads and hopefully run with the right answer.
Yeah.
You know, if we could bat 300, I feel pretty good. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, actually, I do. I find myself more these days asking the question of, why am I doing this? Or is this necessary? Is this being helpful because I really want to be helpful and I think there's something I can give in this situation? Or am I trying to do something like make this person like me? I mean, I find myself more and more these days. Maybe it's because in the past few years, with studying a little bit of the Enneagram, and my wife is studying it as well, and we talk about it a little bit more together because we're a 2 and a 5 together, and therefore it helps us to talk about it. But I've found myself asking the question more instead of just diving into things.
You know, there's a question that has really intrigued me for a while now, and I think it's a question that all types could ask in these moments, in these sort of gap moments where we're wondering about what we should do, right? And the question is, you know, just to pause and say, what does love require of me right now?
That's a great question. That's a great question.
Does love require me to say no? Does love require me to say yes, even though I want to say no, or vice versa? You know, does it require me to be quiet? Does it require me to say something? Does just to me, that question haunts me a lot.
That's a great question to evaluate your motives and what you're doing or your actions. It is a wonderful question.
So the superpower of the two, this attunement to the needs of other people, the ability to anticipate needs, which is fairly amazing. But when unhealthy, the unspoken expectation that someone else will meet our needs for us without our even having to acknowledge we have any. Is that your experience as a two? Did you have like, for example, can you tell when you have strings attached to your giving to another person when it's not altruistic?
Yes, I think I can.
How do you know?
Because, you know, if there, I would say there's a inner conniver. and hopefully I can catch it in time. But I think they're probably, it just, you just know when you're not right, you know? You just know.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I like what you just said, the inner conniver. Because here's the thing that people, so I think people have a stereotype of every type, right? You know, every four wears a beret and smokes clove cigarettes and reads French poetry. Right?
Sure.
You know, and every eight is, you know, a elbow throwing, bar brawling, you know what I'm saying? Like, like these are stereotypes of people. And I think some people have this two stereotype of like the hugger, the kid, you know what I mean? Like always the mom with the casserole showing up, you know?
Yeah.
And that, to me, that's a little bit of a stereotype. I mean, I get it, but it's a little bit of a distorted picture, right? And one of the things, and every type's got its dark sides. Let's just visit the dark side of two here for a second.
Sure.
Because, so there is a conniving dimension to the unhealthy too. The twos can be very ambitious. They can be very manipulative. They can be deceptive. They can use people in order to get ahead, all the while looking like amazingly loving human beings.
What can I say?
Now again, you know, I'm not beating up on twos and twos. You are the number.
There's a shadow side,
right?
Yeah,
but it's hard for people to see it because it's usually so well masked behind this loving, like, I'm doing it all for you,
right?
I'm doing all this for you,
yeah,
sort of a thing.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the good part. We can hide. You know, I also, for me, I don't exactly know how this fits, but the shadow side would be perfectionism and the need not to fail.
Oh, tell me about that, because those are two things I haven't really thought much about.
Well, that might just be another part of my personality.
Maybe, who knows, but let's go there.
But I think a part of the unhealthy too would be doing things for you so that you will like me.
Mm-hmm.
And so you will think good of me. And in the same way, if I do well, if I perform well, you will like me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so perfectionism in doing things, whether it's an event, whether it's a talk, whether it's whatever, if I don't do well, I really have to grapple with it.
Mm.
I have to just grapple with the reality of people fail.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not supposed to.
Right.
But people fail. And if they fail, it doesn't mean that people aren't going to like you. Maybe they may be disappointed. But the pressure not to fail and the pressure to perform well, whether that's in helping or doing, is very strong.
Mm.
And very strong. Yeah.
Do you think that has, I mean, twos, threes, and fours are in the shame triad,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, I mean, what I hear you saying is that shame is really right there for you.
Oh, yeah.
Like the disappointing other people, the shame mm-hmm. of not performing well enough. I mean, has shame been a major theme in your life as a two?
It's a battle. Has been more of in the past, but it still brings this little ugly head up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so instead of, you know, if I fail, instead of going, okay, that was disappointing. There's something I can learn from that. There's something I can grow from that. My first response is shame.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first place I go, and I have to dig out of that hole, and I can usually find my way out, but it takes a little while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Boy, shame is something, isn't it?
Oh, my.
You know, we have our mutual friend, Becca Stevens, who was mm-hmm. on the podcast recently. What's her favorite line? It's like, love is the most powerful force in the universe. Is that mm-hmm. is that her thing? Mm-hmm. And I always say to her, I go, yeah, but shame is right behind.
a close second.
Right?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So in your work as a therapist, what theme of brokenness do you see as running that you have seen more often than other themes? You know what I mean? Like, is there a theme of brokenness that runs through the human soul that you've seen and go, man, there it is again?
You know, my first thought is the refusal to sorrow, the refusal to face sorrow.
Hmm.
It feels like that is a constant theme.
Oh, you got to tell me more about it. I'm a four, so please keep going.
Okay. Speaking your language. So years ago, I taught a course, psychopathology, when I was teaching at Colorado Christian University. And the theme of my course, and I don't know where I got this theme, whether I stole it, whether I made it up. Let's just say I made it up, because that's better, you know.
Right.
Was the flight from sorrow leads to the loss of hope.
Say that again.
The flight from sorrow, running from sorrow,
right,
running away from sorrow, leads to the loss of hope.
Mm.
And it was so interesting because 1 week I would teach on dissociative disorders. They used to be called multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
1 week I would teach on depression. 1 week I would teach on eating disorders, and on and on and on for the whole semester. And every class began with that sentence, the flight from sorrow leads to the loss of hope. And it fit for every situation.
Hmm.
Whether it's depression, if it's non-chemical, whether it's anxiety, whether it's something really tragic that a person won't face, a lot of the issues come down to the fact that someone will not embrace sorrow.
Hmm.
And so in terms of a theme, that's what I see a lot. And that's where I go a lot with people, is let's find that situation, that story, that moment that happened. And everyone has them, that we don't want to deal with, or we don't want to talk about, or we haven't admitted, and grieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you the number of times people have said to me, and I'm sure you've heard this as well, why do we have to go there? That's done. It's over. It's past. I've moved beyond it. Why do we have to go there? And I usually have to give them the bad news because if you don't, you won't be healed. I go, well, what do you mean? And then I pull out the big guns and bring Jesus into it. And said, well, Jesus said the following, blessed are those who mourn. Why? For they will be comforted. And my assumption, if you don't mourn, you will not be. So I think there are a lot of people walking around out there that are not comforted because they've never mourned.
Mm.
So that's the first theme that comes to me.
You know, before we hit record, one of the things I said, you know, and you know, I was actually on the way over here thinking, we first met in 1993, 4, is that right, in Colorado? Yeah.
Actually, what I remember was a friend brought you in after you wrote Chasing Francis, brought you to town, and had dinner with a group of people. Invited me to it.
I think I have an earlier date.
Well,
it was at CCU.
Okay.
I was playing music, and there was a small gathering. I think Mike Cusick may have been involved in this.
Wow.
Is this possible? I think so. And I had written a bunch of songs. I was in town. I was studying at Denver Seminary at the time. You were at CCU.
Mm-hmm.
Is that around that time?
I was there from 90 to 97.
So it would have been around that time.
Yeah.
So I hate to bust it to you. It was 13 years earlier because I wrote Chasing Francis in 2006.
Wow. I must have been helping someone else and not paying attention to you.
Yeah, I obviously didn't have any needs.
No, well, yeah. Wow.
No, I know. Crazy,
ago.
Right?
Yeah.
So here's what's interesting for me. Before we started recording, I just said to you, you know, I've been around you a good number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're a two. There's no question you're a two.
Right.
But you have a very four-like quality as well. And we just heard you kind of give voice to it. You know, this idea of you're so good at moving into dark spaces with people, which is very four-ish.
Mm.
You know, fours have this ability to help walk people into those thin, dark spaces that they either places they don't want to go or they don't want to even acknowledge exist. Hmm. Right. The four is really good at writing a song or doing something. Like we had Andrew Peterson on like 2 weeks ago. And you know, who does that better than Andrew? I mean, yeah, in 3.5 minutes in a song, right, you know, come with me. Let me walk you into your sorrow, you know, and and let you know that at the end of this, you're still going to be alive.
Yeah. And, but I've sobbed through many of his songs.
I know. Yes. Exactly, yeah, exactly. Right. So I wonder, you know, twos and fours share a line on the Enneagram. And when a two's in a really good space, they tend to look and act like a healthy four. And so what I was wondering as you were describing that is boy, am I watching, listening right now to a two who is so evolved that they are hard for me to tell the difference between them and a healthy four in a way, you know? Because a couple of moments when you were talking about, you know, how important it is to move into mourning and stuff, I have this attunement thing in me. I know when something falls on a room. I know when a silence hits a room not to move, right? And there were two or three times when you were talking, I was like, don't move. It's a very important idea. And it's being spoken with so much authority. This notion of, and for a two to not get all busy and happy and chirpy, but to allow someone to move into suffering with them, pretty powerful. Pretty powerful. And really deeply moving to hear you talk about it.
It's something I would never have talked about in my 20s. I would have avoided it. I would have avoided me now. Because I wouldn't have wanted to go there. Wouldn't have thought it was necessary and was frankly frightened of it.
Did you just say what I think you said? Did you just say in my 20s I would have avoided me?
Yeah. Yes, voided me, the 65-year-old.
Therapist.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, here we go.
Oh, the 20-year-old me would have avoided, the 20-year-old me would have avoided me now.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, totally. And I would say the 20-year-old knew that something was wrong. But was terrified to go for help. Terrified. Yeah. So, yeah.
So, all right. So, your 20-year-old Allie Andrews is here in the room, or another 25-year-old, too, just trying to find their way in the world. And they come to you and they say, Al, can you save me some time? What would you tell me to save me some time and heartache? I'm like, well, what would you just tell me to do?
You know, I'm not sure which book this was in, but when Richard Rohr talks about the ascent and the descent,
right?
At that time, oh gosh, a few years ago, I was leading a group, maybe 10 years ago, of folks who were in their early 20s. And I began talking about some of these things, like, let's go to places of sorrow. And it just didn't work. And then I heard or read Rohr saying something like, your job with a 20-year-old is not to draw them into the ascent, to the descent, not to draw them into the place of sorrow, but just to let them know that it's coming. Because as a 20-year-old, the things that I dealt with in my 30s in counseling had already happened to me. And have happened to most 20-year-olds already. You know, by the time they're 20, the thing they're going to deal with in therapy in their 40s has already happened. But they're just not ready to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing I would say to the 20-year-old me, I still like having him in the room, would be, it's coming. It's coming. Sorrow is coming because some things have happened to you, because they happened to everybody. A snake comes into everyone's garden early in their life and takes innocence away. And so that's already happened to you. And you're going to have to deal with it one day. And if you want to start edging toward it, I'd be glad to do that with you. But I would probably take some smaller steps with that person. I'm not sure exactly what they'd be, to kind of warm them up to the idea. I have met some 20-year-olds who are ready to go there, but others not. And so I think I would just say, there's a day coming where you're going to have to look at some things, but it's not right now. And when you're ready, let's talk.
Mm-hmm. Is that a blanket statement for everybody? Or is it just a general truth, maybe is a better way to put this, that, and it's a great way for us to maybe kind of put a period on the end of the sentence of this conversation, that this is going to sound very, you know, Eeyore-ish maybe, or draconian, or whatever you want to say, right? But the fact of the matter is, regardless of your type, for each of us, a time of sorrow comes.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great mistake to refuse its invitation. In refusing the invitation to mourn, to have sorrow, your soul will revolt if you refuse that invitation. And that that revolt may come in the form of depression, anxiety, feelings of lost, no sense of identity, you know, run off and have an affair,
yeah,
go start an addiction, whatever it is, your soul will tell you, you need to allow this suffering, to face this suffering. And I think for every type, that's something, that's just a general human truth.
Yes, I would say that is a universal truth. And you could put a period at the end of that.
Yeah. But there's hope in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because facing it does bring comfort.
Yeah.
And healing.
Well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, whoever you are listening.
That's right.
We for sure need to look at the brokenness of our type, of our manner of being in the world, face the sorrow of what it's done to us and others, embrace that which is most beautiful about who we are, and
absolutely,
and also embrace what's most broken. Yeah, about who we are. Well, I could talk to you forever, Al. We could sit around here doing this all afternoon.
Just, we could. We sure could.
It's so good, man. I'm so honored you came on and gave some voice and language to what it looks like to be a healthy, wise Enneagram 2.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and it's been a pleasure being here. It really has been.
Well, Typology Tribe, once again, please don't forget the words of the great Oscar Wilde. Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken.